I'm given the task, and I have the pleasure of actually inviting all of you to a reception about 5:30 this afternoon. Let me give you the address. It's Bronfman Building. It is at the corner of this very street, McTavish, on Sherbrooke. It's right at the corner of this street. We are on the sixth floor. McGill International Executive Lounge. So please join us, and it's going to go on between 5:30 to 8:30, whenever the food finishes and the wine finishes. So please do join us there. Corner of McTavish and corner of McTavish and Sherbrooke, sixth floor. Please join us there. Thank you. Rod, Professor McNaughton.
Thank you. Your consummate planner for the day, Alan, has been constantly changing the program as it goes along, and you don't even know, right? He's had four different plans since noon. The day is getting a little bit long, and you'll notice that we have lost a few of our participants. The original plan was that we would have a series of roundtable conversations addressing specific questions, and that we'd have opportunities for each of those tables to report back. But given the number of people that we have lost, given that the lateness of the day and those kinds of things, and I don't know if you've all noticed, because no one's been too shy, but we've been video and audio recording the day, we would like to actually capture some of the discussion that takes place. So my good colleague Paul Gill, from University of Waterloo, who's sitting over there, has been paying closer attention than the rest of us today. And he has come up with a series of questions that sort of distill some of the central issues that have come out of the panels. And he came up with a rather long list of them because we were hoping to have a number of tables discuss them. But we've chosen four of these. So rather than give them to individual tables, I'm hoping to just moderate a discussion here between all of us as a group. And so the first question that we thought was quite important, it appears on purpose, of course, we have academics here who are staying through the weekend for the 13th McGill Conference on International Entrepreneurship. And most of those people have come from other countries. So by definition, we have a group of academics here. We also invited people who attended the symposium at Waterloo last April, who were primarily composed of business people and some government representatives. And in addition, of course, we have invited some of the local business community. So by definition, throughout the day, we have had these three different communities represented here in the room. But it often seems throughout the day that while we talk about interaction between these three groups, that in fact, these things are still silos. So we've heard entrepreneurs say things about government programs that they perhaps are not ideally suited to meet their needs, or the timing of how the programs work don't work well with how quickly entrepreneurs need to get things done. We hear governments say things like, we have a very different set of concerns than entrepreneurs do, and you have to understand that our programs are a compromise. We have academics who say that we are creating knowledge and we would really like to share it with the world, but there are difficulties in doing that. So the first question then is about how can we start to break down the silos between government, industry, and academia, because it is in all of our interest to do so to promote Canadian entrepreneurship. Okay, so I would love to start to receive some comments on how we might approach this issue. I would mention, as I did mention, that we're audio and video recording this. If you could wait to receive the microphone, and that way it's not so much that you'll hear us, it's that we'll have a record of it.
I'm going to do two things. I'm going to tell you about an OECD study, and then I'm going to tell you about a country or a group of countries that have transcended the barrier that the OECD study found. The OECD study interviewed companies all around the world. It was about this phenomenon of open innovation. And they asked companies who do you collaborate with? First of all, how many companies collaborate and how many don't? And they have a nice chart, and there's a certain percentage by OECD country of companies that collaborate. And it's never 100%, it's 50%, and it goes down to 10% in some countries. And then they ask them, who do you collaborate with? And number one was customers and suppliers. And the distant second was competitors, private sector labs, and consultants. And a distant third was universities and government. So that's the world talking. That's the world industry community talking. And they're saying the valuable partners, the lowest of them are the universities and government. And it's interesting, when you read the OECD study, you can just see the writer sort of the eyebrows raised and sort of, you know, isn't this interesting? And they actually say, I can't verbatim quote it, they say, this is a very interesting finding because most policy people think that industry, innovative companies are driven by university research. And they sort of scratching their head. I didn't find it surprising because of the work Doug and I have been doing, and we've been talking to companies, and they say, you know, we're in the value creation game, and we need customers, and universities and governments aren't customer-oriented. The most important thing industry finds in universities is the people, not the IP, and that's universal. But here's the interesting thing. The OECD has a beautiful chart, a bar chart, by OECD country. And they have one chart for the percentage of a country's companies that collaborate with government. And they do it for large companies, and they do it for SMEs. And what they found, and you can see it, it's visually very stunning, it's just the countries down here in bar charts, dark bars for the large companies and light bars for the SMEs. And the SMEs are almost, you know, down at the bottom where Canada is in Japan. It's less than 2% of SMEs collaborate with government. And it goes all the way up, and the top country is Finland, where 10% of the SMEs collaborate with government. And for the large companies, it's much more varied, and Finland's at the top for them too. 50% of large companies in Finland collaborate with government, down to less than 2% for countries like Canada. I talked with Director General of Innovation in the Finnish Department of the Economy. We had an hour-long telephone conversation, and I said to him, Petri, I described the study, he knew it. I said, why Finland? Why are you right at the top? And by the way, the other countries that were near the top were Scandinavian countries. And all the small countries that Doug referred to that are ahead of us in prosperity measure. Interesting. And I said, well, what have you done? He said, three things. One, all the direct support that government in Finland gives to companies has a requirement attached to it. No company will get public money unless they collaborate with universities and they collaborate with government. And this has been going on since the 1980s. And so they have a strong culture of collaboration between the three groups that you were talking about in Finland because they've mandated it, and the mighty dollar is the thing that does it. They also, all their innovation policy, all their technology policy, all their industrial policy is cluster-driven. And so, and they view a cluster as lead companies, which are usually large, then all their suppliers and their customers and their partners, which can be large, but a lot of SMEs, and the public sector institutions. And they've been building clusters through this funding policy that way for since the 1980s, so 80s, 90s, the 10s, for 30 years. He said the downside is that now all these clusters, that they have a strong collaborative clusters around the country, And they dominate all the funding, so now they're scratching their heads, how can we get new things going? Because these people just know the system so well. But so you can have a policy that will help answer your question. So that's a long story just to tell you an example around the OECD. So
we have a number of guests here from Finland. Is there anyone from Finland who would care to respond with, you know, the actual experience of living in that context? And, you know, you're probably academics if you're from Finland, so how are universities encouraged? You were primarily talking about cooperating with government. Any comments on university collaboration there? Oh, sorry, at the back. Not from Finland, though.
I spend my life there. One of the things, we've finished a major review for the Finnish government, which involved 12 Finnish academics and 6 international academics. And one of the things we looked at was entrepreneurship in Finland. And interestingly, Finland has had a number of departments looking at small business. It has not really had an established entrepreneurship identity, although there are some very good scholars. One of the recommendations which was adopted was that Finland, because of its structure, because of its small size, and because of its peripherality to mainland Europe, however attractive a country, actually needed to concentrate its activities. And partly as a result of this major invited review by the government, Aalto University has become the center of much of their innovation and entrepreneurship activity. So it's interesting in terms of a Canadian context, in that I think Finland, however ruefully, has recognized that it cannot dissipate its resources in a country with approximately 5 million people. So you're seeing a focus very much around centers of excellence in the capital city. And that is a really quite brave political decision that they made. Whether my Finnish colleagues would disagree profoundly. Thank you.
There's a comment over here.
Thank you. One of the things we didn't talk about on the panel and we wanted to get to was academe. And I think it's notable that the Waterloo report was quite soft on academic contribution to the issue. And it seems to me this isn't rocket scientists. We just need science. We need some incentives. And we do not have an infrastructure within academe that would incite change. And it has to, and it can only happen at the presidential level, if we're going to have amalgamation of engineering and management departments and multidisciplinary programs, because right now the funding models and the tenure processes do not support innovation. They support the status quo. So I think my suggestion, as we are still feeling comfortable in academe, and we know through Tom's work that productivity is indeed a problem in our country, that unless at a very senior level from industry, the message goes to the presidents to say, we've got to create an incentive through the provincial funding mechanisms to change the culture and the decision-making processes through universities, we academics will continue to sit very comfortably and sometimes cuddle with industry and sometimes cuddle with government, but there is really no material incentive other than goodwill. Just a thought.
Hi, I'm Karl-Mack from Sweden, beginning my PhD adventure. And I was thinking, one thing we have done in Gothenburg that could hopefully help in building the culture and bridging between these three different sectors, so to say, is utilizing people from industry and entrepreneurs in education that we, for example, make a specific education for municipalities, is it right? Yeah, that is one part of the government actor, with specific build programs or courses in entrepreneurship to help educate in an academic setting and therefore building culture, but also taking in people from industry in that learning environment. And also we're building a executive MBA program for PhDs, but that was sort of in a Erasmus program with the EU. But it is examples of how it could you could help building the positive culture and understanding between these different actors in bridging between governmental and educational academia and also industry.
Sorry, just point of clarification. The executive MBA for PhDs, is that like PhDs in a technical discipline to give them some business knowledge?
Yes, sorry, and I just said MBA also. We are trying to build a MBA that focuses on entrepreneurship and early innovation, so it's a little bit different. It is also a little bit
commercialization knowledge to people who are scientists and engineers.
Yes, but of course it's focused on... I'm from the medical faculty, so we just build a department within the medical faculty in innovation and entrepreneurship, but also within technical areas. Innovation-strong areas, one could say, would be the main focus.
Really good meeting, Al. Well done. I'd like to build on what Barb started, because while high-level leadership in the university would be required, a lot of work at the grassroots would be required, too. If we think of ourselves as university faculty, we get degrees within a discipline. Our appointment is within a disciplinary department, with letters of reference from a discipline. Our promotions, tenure, ditto, ditto, ditto. Our grants are adjudicated by disciplinary committees. And it goes on and on. Any recognition is through the discipline. The university provides an inadequate parking lot, a library, and lousy food service. I mean, that's what you got, okay? So... I think there's room not only for leadership at the top, but also for work within the disciplines to help the disciplines evolve, particularly at the exciting borders with adjacent disciplines. And that'll take it'll take two things. It'll take the leadership of faculty members as individuals, and it will take the university's willingness to accept things other than strict disciplinary publications as measures of the quality of the intellectual effort. I think it's worth doing. And I'd like to think that, in fact, management education itself is... because one has to combine excellence in the quality of the research, which produces the facts which are incorporated education, and influence, on the other hand, by the graduates, by the researchers, by people who read the research results, that management education might be a good place to begin that. What do you think, Barb?
Yeah, I agree. As long as we can improve funding costs.
Barb doesn't get up in the morning unless you pay her?
I do want to drive that point home, that unless you look at how the funds are allocated across the university, at this point, at least in one university that I'm familiar with, it's punitive. And so we really have to work with the senior admin at the same time, because until that is addressed, you won't have the kind of buy-in that you need across faculty to create these teams. So you're right, it has to come at both levels together.
Just to join in on this one as well, I think I may have said before, the problems of commercialization are deeply cultural. They're down here. They have very little to do with up here. And the same problem is true within the faculty at a university. And let me give you an example of that. And some of you will have heard me talk about this before. One of the big things about the universities in the United States and why the United States, one of the reasons why the United States is number one in the knowledge-based economy of the world and is the largest country that's up there. We're the next largest country and we're sitting at number 10. All those OECD or the G7 or the G8 countries that we talk about, yeah, we can brag about being number one or number two in prosperity amongst them, but they're not prosperous. They're not prosperous. They're down in the dregs. It's countries like Finland and Sweden and Austria and places like that that are up above. And as Jeff has pointed out, some of that comes because of collaboration. What we don't talk about is the collaboration that happens in the United States and the effect that it has on the faculty and on the learning environments for post-secondary learners. I was really surprised to find out that the 9-3 kind of thing works even for the humanities in the United States, that you're hired by the university for 9 months, and you got to get out there into the community and be a commercial animal. Create value and get value in exchange for the other 3 months. And the good universities expect you not to get 3 months' worth. They're going to give you some credit if in the 3 months you get 6 months' worth. And in the case of MIT, you can get to belong to the 10% club, which says your university salary is less than 10% of what you earn. And that's an honorable society. I can tell you that at McMaster, that would be dishonorable. You would be disowned by the faculty. And so I'm saying it's not just about pay. It's about whether you get respected or whether you get dragged through the mud or not. And I happen to know some profs there that I think could at least belong to the 20% club, where their university remuneration is less than 20%. Of what they take, but I can tell you they operate below the radar. Nobody knows how much they're making out there or how they're doing. They don't disclose it at all because it would harm them if the university knew that. I'm talking about the collegial group. So it isn't just about pay. It's also about reputation and about how you're treated. And this is real gut-level stuff. So it's deeply cultural, and it's hard to know how you go about fixing those. I was encouraged by the young women and other people who talked here today about things that can be done for young entrepreneurs. But I think a lot of the shaping of our really bright students, and we have them in Canada, and we educate them as well as is educated anywhere in the world, but it's in an environment where commerce is devalued. It's not good for faculty members to even use the word. And talking about them having a customer, I know you can practically get punched in the face for suggesting that they have customers. So there's deep issues here. Deep issues.
If I may just add, when I did my undergraduate degree in commerce more than 20 years ago, most of the professors which I had were, you know, full-time or associate, but the best courses, the ones that left me with a greater impression, were by lecturers, so people from outside.
The back? Sorry. Well, if there's one right at the table, that's easier then. But then we won't have a copy of it. Yes.
Can I perhaps be slightly provocative? Entrepreneurship is the red light area of the university. It's, broadly speaking, an illegitimate mongrel. It's not science, it's not economics, it's not physics, it's not the natural sciences, and we're in different ball games to Archimedes. And in some ways, there's two trends. I mean, I was at London Business School, which has an excellent entrepreneurship centre. It is one of the factors that discriminates London Business School as probably one of the top two or three business schools in the world. In terms of the status within the faculty, it was very, very low. In terms of the students' attraction, it was very, very high. What we have seen in terms of the positive sides is that entrepreneurship is starting to become legitimate. It's becoming legitimate because it's been adopted by mainstream economists. Not because it's had anything to do with commerce or the wider economy, young firms. You have Josh Lerner, you have David Aldrich, you have Zoltan Axe, who are very fine economists and are used to negotiating and communicating with government. And you're seeing a major trend of economists at last becoming interested in the role of entrepreneurship within the production function. So that, in one sense, entrepreneurship is now becoming much more seriously viewed, but from an economic space, or in some cases, a psychology base. When it comes to its relevance to growing firms, the reality is that many academics have very, very little to say. And London recognized that by saying, we will take very fine entrepreneurs who wish to put something back into the community, and we will engage with them in courses, many of which they will run, but we won't put them with PhDs, and we won't pretend they're academics. And in some cases, we have to adopt a humility, strange word coming from me, about what we can and what we can't do. Because when it comes to a rigorous inquiry in an academic sense, very much of what we do and we wish to communicate to young companies, growing companies, is not really relevant. And in some ways, we're crying at the moon if we expect entrepreneurs to be seen as very, very high-level academics and to be communicators. Some of the finest entrepreneurship academics I know wouldn't know what a firm was if it hit them in the street. And many of them wouldn't care. Now, they can still be valuable, but they do not relate at the level of young firms because they have often very, very little to say. But there is a community that does, and that's a more applied academics. I mean, you know, the 600 high-tech young firms internationalizing I studied, we directly relate to both government and to those firms about what we have learned. And that's highly practical, but it's got lots of economic regressions and everything else, which we'd never communicate. And so we kind of need to be a bit more sophisticated in our thinking. And we should always invite firms, businesses, entrepreneurs into the university. And until very recently, it has been incredibly difficult for those people to get into our ivory towers, in part because we haven't wanted them, and in part because we haven't known a common language to talk. But the last thing, and probably the biggest significance in terms of us relating to the wider business community, at least in the UK, is we are now individually, formally judged on our impact and our esteem in terms of our work. So we now actually have to stand up and be counted and say, okay, I spent 20 years researching that. What damn use is it whatsoever other than I published in Journal of Business Venturing? And that's a new hurdle, and it's going to be a very, very challenging hurdle for many of us. But it's interesting times.
There's one over here.
I guess I'd just like to sort of comment on what Gordon was saying, but there's also some inherent dangers here. with the Australian Graduate School of Entrepreneurship, which I was a doctoral student at until recently, because it's gone down. First of all, we called those people that came in from industry pracademics, and they were highly important in our MEI program, which was basically an academic with a pracademic from industry teaching a course and building a course within an 8 sort of course program. Now, what happened was the business faculty and the engineering faculty, which were two of the big faculties at Swinburne, and the support above them just wasn't there. They were doing a lot of things, getting a lot of different grants, going out to industry, getting a lot of money to do what they were doing. But at the end of the day, they did not have the mechanisms, they did not have the structure to be able to take what they've done and build on it. Because anytime you have an entrepreneurship center or an entrepreneurship school within a business school, it's a cash cow. Because we can get money from those entrepreneurs. It's very, very important to these people who've gone out and done it, made a lot of money, want to give back philanthropically. So there are very big dangers here with trying to put entrepreneurship into a curriculum in a business school or into a university as it is. I've seen it in Australia. It was devastating. There was a very good Babson-like program there, and now it's gone. So to be able to do this, there's a lot of different questions you have to ask yourself. Is the business school the right place for academic entrepreneurship? Should it be somehow structured within a different type of organization within the university? Should it be multi-campus? These are sort of the questions we have to look at and take a look at what's out there in terms of models, I think, to see what is actually happening, what's the best, what's working, and who is surviving, and more importantly, who's growing, like the London School of Business.
I missed what you said. There were a few key things that led to the decline in failure of it. What were those key things?
Structure. They were within the business school. They didn't have their own sort of budgetary sort of ability to chart their own future. There was also no public or top administrative support. The chancellor just...
You mean lack of?
No, there was a lack of support there. There was a focus on sciences, engineering, physics, all those kind of good things. And there was also no... sort of real interchange between what was going on in the business school and what was going on in the engineering school. And I think that was another reason for it going down the way that it did. So, like I said, just some cautions here for those who think that entrepreneurship is the solution to all things. It could be quite disastrous if you go about it the wrong way.
Thank you. There's one very close to you, and then I have one up front.
Thank you. I think there's an angle in the discussion that is missing today, because we have talked a lot about entrepreneurship, we've talked about financing and the venture capital and SMEs. What about the large companies and the role they play in commercializing innovation? At Ontario Centers of Excellence, we do have the new entrepreneur programs and the seed financing. But that represents about 15% of what we do. The bulk of our role is to be a bridge between the large companies and academic research. 85% of what we do, and we are not the government, we are a company. We are a nonprofit company with contracts from the provincial and the federal government, and our role, our mandate is to be that bridge between companies, large or small, and academia. And 85% of what we do is dealing with the large receptors, the IBM, the Siemens, the GE, and connecting them with the solution in university, and we fund half of the cost of the research. But the contract is between the large company and academia. We are just matchmakers, facilitators, and we generate far more prosperity for the province of Ontario by doing this than by promoting entrepreneurship and the startup company. So we do this because it is... there's not a single solution to this. It's multifactorial, so we have to cover the whole spectrum. But the bulk of this, in our view, is the large receptors and matching them with academia for these research contracts.
Tom, do you still have a...
It hit me just a couple of minutes ago that we've been sitting here all day talking about entrepreneurship, and it's not clear, we haven't demonstrated, that we all mean the same thing by it. I have encountered a number of definitions of innovation. I've encountered a number of definitions of entrepreneurship. Let me simply ask if this is the definition of entrepreneurship that we've been discussing or implying in our discussions. Entrepreneurship is the capacity to find and seize new opportunities to create value. Okay? Now, there are all sorts of people that carry the title entrepreneur whose contribution is finding new ways to spend money, generally somebody else's, generally from the public purse, and there are other phrases with the word entrepreneur attached to them. But do you buy this one for this discussion? that an entrepreneur is someone with the ability to find and seize opportunities, new opportunities to create value. Doug, do you buy that?
I was designated the Ontario Entrepreneur of the Year in technology. And I remember thinking, what on earth is an entrepreneur anyway, you know? And I asked quite a few people, and I didn't get a very good answer. I must say, that fits just fine for me.
Any other comments on that one?
Just to add, Denis Martel from Industry Canada, we do use a definition of entrepreneurship, which has been developed with the OECD, so it took a few years, but it's very close to what you're alluding, which one thing is important is not about success, it's about trying, which is what you want. You want successful entrepreneurs, but as being entrepreneur, you don't know about the success. The only part that the OECD added to your part, it's seeking new markets. It's not only products or services, but it can also be a new market. So.
New opportunities to create value. That's not value without the market. Well,
we're talking about the same thing, essentially. I think we agree.
Okay. Oh, sorry, Paul has a comment.
Thank you. Yeah, Tom, I think you hit a really important point. We probably are not working with the same definition, but let's remember the question we started with, and that is, are we living in silos at this point still? And I think that we do have representation in the room from the academy, from industry, and from government, and it is a bit of progress that we might agree on a working definition, one that probably would evolve if we were really putting our mind to the understanding and the improvement of how we manage innovation. But I think we still have these silos. These are three solitudes, and there's not a meeting of the mind. And I think until we get to that point, we come under one hat, because under pressure, when we're asked to explain why things are falling short of expectation, we're still tending to point to the other areas. Say, well, the problem's over here. No, it's clearly over here. Well, the problem is here for every one of us that represents a perspective on this. And I just am still challenged with the question, what do we do to break down these solitudes? You know, it's been now half a century since C.P. Snow wrote about two solitudes. Well, we've made progress. We've made three. And never it's not the twain, never the three shall meet, it seems, because that's part of what we've been bumping into all day, is different perceptions, different takes, and different things that we will emphasize depending on the perspective that we have. And so how do we get within a jurisdiction like Canada, and for that matter, any jurisdiction in the world, how do we bring together those three perspectives? Tom, you've talked about three-legged people. So at the individual level, somebody like Tom can express this model of somebody who's had experience in academe, some years of work, and made accomplishment there, somebody who's done it in government, and somebody, and the same person doing it in industry, all three experiences. But the problems are larger now. You need an eye big enough to see all of the implications of fast-moving technologies and market opportunities and so on. How do we manage an eye big enough and bring it together under sort of a collective problem space and then go and solve it? Working on a definition is a good first step. I dare say, though, we still have the problem that you read out to us at the beginning, Rod.
I wonder if we covered a number of sort of ancillary topics to that, but I wonder if anyone has some concrete examples. I mean, one example would be what we've done today. It may not be an excellent one, but it is an example of bringing those parties together. So I was just wondering if Paul has another comment, but maybe we could talk about, if you know about, because there's people here from different parts of the world, are there some good examples that you can think about of policies or practices that have tried to address that specific problem?
I think today has given us hope. I think that there is a chance to bring these perspectives together. I'm also inspired a bit by what the Network Centers of Excellence are doing there. They've organized a call for proposals on knowledge mobilization, and I think that's intrinsically a multi-perspective challenge. It's not to fund new research. It's to take extant knowledge and put it to work. I think these are healthy signs. I think today's event has been a healthy sign. Even when we don't agree, it's the first step to bringing together the different perspectives. And I think that NCE call, it's too late if you were thinking of writing a proposal to. The call went in on the 14th of September. But we'll wait and see what kinds of proposals they've received. Because if it is about knowledge mobilization, where the knowledge already has to exist, how do you put it to work, and can you bring these different perspectives to bear on the exercise?
Barb has a comment.
I'd like to return back to an earlier point and find out what these performance indicators are, including some of the things that your organization is implementing in terms of impact measures on faculty performance, or impact measures in terms of some of the economic development agencies in terms of reach into academe and other silos. I've never seen a paper that looked at impact measures to try and bridge, so that might be another starting point. But just to kick off that, maybe if you could speak a little bit about how academic impact.
It terrifies the academic community. We know what publications are, and we know what funds raised are. Impact and peer assessment, or impact and external assessment. Is a movable feast. It has been mandated by government that it will be one of the key elements of the latest review, which is the Research Excellence Framework, which will be 2013. And there is intense debate as to how we are going to assess objectively the nature of impact. My instinct is that what we will see is academics being asked for illustration of the utilization of their work. For scientists, that will not be a problem. For economists and management scientists, it may well be a problem. In my own area, it's not a problem, but I think we are going to have an area which will be a source of contention and vicious and bitter academic debate for the next decade. The government is insistent that it needs to know what it's spending its money on, and it will not probably listen very closely to an argument of the semantics and the philology of definition. It will say essentially, is it worth putting money in what you're doing when we have a £70 billion deficit? And it's going to be very unfair, it's going to be very biased, and it's going to play very strongly to those in centres of excellence which have strong linkages with international high-status companies or high-status government. But it's going to be the least objective and the most subjective and the most contentious of the reference frameworks. But the irony is academics don't know what it is. Most entrepreneurs and government think they do. And at the moment, government has got the whip hand. Can I make one very quick suggestion about examples, which links academe to practice? The British government wanted to work on venture capital, or wanted to know why we weren't as good as America. It asked me that about 6 years ago. What in asking that said, they asked me, would I do a study saying why America's better than the UK? What they showed me was that, unbelievable to me, senior civil servants hadn't read any of the publications in entrepreneurship for the last 40 years. And what's more, they weren't bothered. And so what we did was to say, rather than doing a study, why don't we do a literature review? And the theme of the literature review was, what do we know, what don't we know, and what should we know? And I got a very bright Swedish postdoc, and I paid her £6,000, and she worked with an established academic, Johan Wiklund, and they reviewed 120 of the top articles in venture capital over the last 10 years and came out with a set of statements. We know that small venture capital funds are ineffective and lose money. We know that specialization is correlated to performance. And this, so we had a series of what we know. And this directly impacted on the structure that we used in the British government to create the enterprise capital funds, which are of an order of £1 billion. We also, in a very similar way, the Australian government paid me my suggestion to do some research to look at what is the minimum viable size of a venture capital fund. I did that work and gave them an answer, which is about $100 million. Below that, you're really at risk because all the viabilities have breakdown. That has been used by five governments in looking at their early stage policies. And so, in some senses, we have got to put ourselves about with government in order that they will appreciate, because what you get is a situation where they would like to work with us, where they would like to understand, but they're under enormous pressure very often for time. They're finance constrained as well. And literature searches are a really simple thing to do. You can do them very quickly. Postdocs are very skilled at doing them. And we've just finished one looking at, knowledge base, or investment readiness. It's a great phrase, investment readiness. What the hell does it mean? And so I've had an Italian postdoc from Bocconi who has reviewed about 100 papers and schemes in about 10 countries and tried to extract what from those schemes, what from those papers were, if you like, it's not like physics, they're not rules, but if you like, increases the probability that one, you will not do something really, really stupid, and two, you will work on the basis of what is already learned by other countries, other schemes, other programs. And that is a really simple way where we're actually using existing knowledge. We're not doing huge research which is going to take 5 years to have any results. We're saying, what does the Academy of Management Review, what does Journal of Business Venturing, what does ETMP, Entrepreneurship Theory and Practice, say that policymakers and businessmen can actually use? And there is actually a great deal, but we need to translate it. This will not be done by policymakers, it will not be done by business people, it will be done by us. And it's a measure of how effective we are. If we can translate what is patently effective that can be used by practitioners. So there's one suggestion. Literature reviews before you waste a great deal of money in programs, forgetting that they've already done that in Finland, Germany, Sweden, Spain, and they have results. They know what goes well. They know what goes wrong. Some of it may translate, some of it won't, but a lot will translate. And we are very, very poor at cross-government learning, and academics have played an unfortunately small part in that cross-country, that cross-discipline learning. And the onus is on us, I think, to do it. Sorry, I'm standing on the pulpit.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further comment on that one, or would you like one more question?
This question of metrics is always a kind of an important question. And again, around McMaster, there's a couple of metrics that I talk about because I feel that very often in the
in the academic world, and certainly for McMaster, which is a very scholarly oriented university, its focus is very internal on its scholars and on the quality and reputation of their scholarship. That is what it measures and what it really values. The problem with that is that even though they will say that they're very student-centered and student-focused, it's not true, because you don't get promoted or valued within the university on any kind of metrics related to students. And the big thing, when we talk about the $12 billion that Canada's public money that we spend on research and development, probably about 10 of that is actually within the universities. It's principally about graduate students. It's not actually about the knowledge. In fact, the knowledge that we generate in Canada is less than 0.7% of the new knowledge of the world every year with what we measure. It's actually, when you're out there in global commerce, you know that the knowledge that we generate here isn't what's important. What's important is the people that learn in those environments and what they do learn. That's what's important to those of us that are in commerce. And one of the things, of course, is our researchers are generally pretty well connected with their peers all over the world. And they kind of put the graduate students in touch with those same people. So they learn how to be in touch with the knowledge of the world and the knowledgeable people of the world. And that's a huge asset. That's something that we do really well. But we don't have any metric for how our students perform that we get measured on. And just so you think that that isn't impossible, I keep on talking every once in a while about MIT. The vision of MIT is to prepare their students to change the country and change the world. It's a very outward-looking kind of mission. It's about their students and what they do for them. They don't suffer at all academically. They're a small university with 10,000 students. And they have 7 Nobel Prize winners on staff, on faculty. You can hardly find that out on their site. They don't put it all up in big, bold print or something like that. But one thing that is up more in bold print is that in the late 90s, they commissioned a study by a third-party consulting company to go out and find out how many enterprises in the world were being led by MIT graduates and how were they doing. I don't know the precise numbers, but it was roughly 4,000 companies in the world, and they totaled up their gross sales, and it was about $250 billion. And they said, okay, we'll divide that by 2 and say this is the GDP of the influence of MIT, about $125 billion, and that would place us as the 24th largest economic entity on the face of the earth. Okay, I thought when I read that paper from MIT, would we even attempt to do that at McMaster? And would it fly? What kind of response would there be from the faculty for doing that kind of a measurement? And I thought, boy, you wouldn't get a measurement like that off the ground. And I think now that we have a graduate who's just become the CEO of, why am I having trouble with Nokia in Finland? Many universities could be very proud of their graduates if they kept track. In fact, where's Tom gone? I sat on the NSERC Council for quite a number of years, and I used to say to NSERC, if you really want to publish the value that we do by funding all of these graduate students in university, we should be following them and making sure that we know what they're doing and what we've prepared them to do and what they're achieving. That's the outcome that we need to track. We don't do that in Canada. Now, just in case you think that MIT might be a separate kind of example, Bloomberg Press published in December the agonizing of Harvard over the crash of the banks. These were graduates of Harvard 20 and 30 years ago, and Harvard was saying,
these are our graduates. What didn't we do for them? And they have been in a curriculum evaluation ever since, and I gather Yale has too, and I think there are some others that have been in that kind of turmoil about what their learning environment is like because of a kind of a calamity that happened, and they see their former students as having been part of that. It's a very different kind of environment when the learning environments will take responsibility for the people that go through their environment and say, take credit for what they do, like the 4,000 companies that MIT graduates were leading, and also say, boy, there's probably something we can pull up our socks on here because these are our graduates that made some things happen that aren't that desirable. I don't know where else in the world that is done, but I don't think that kind of evaluation is done in Canada. And I'm somebody who would say, until we start to evaluate ourselves on the basis of what our learners do when they get out there, there's going to be a whole lot of things that we don't have to connect with them, we don't have to be involved in them. We've kind of washed our hands of them. In fact, I'm always surprised that a PhD student can hang in there for 3 or 4 years, and in 2 years' time, the professor doesn't even know where they are. So I'm just saying there are metrics that I can think about, and I'm living in an academic institution at the moment, where I think we could benefit a great deal and we could begin to get a culture going that doesn't recognize the walls in the silos as being quite so thick and quite so pure.
Perhaps related to that discussion, we could move on to another question that picks up on that idea. One of the other questions that we have here relates to this notion of people who are out there doing it and making it happen have certain knowledge. People in academia who study those people also have certain knowledge. And there are two different kinds of knowledges. Right? The people who have actually done it have a lot of in-depth experience, probably with their own venture and maybe one or two other at the most. The people in academia may have no experience at all doing it themselves, but they have looked at patterns and trends and relationships over a large number of enterprises that have gone through the commercialization path. So the issue is, and again, this relates to silos, we have people who both have knowledge that is very valuable to the commercialization process, but it's structured in very different ways. So if we want to impact students, for example, first of all, to encourage them that entrepreneurship is a path they should consider, but second of all, to provide them with the skills and tools to help them do it better or faster to avoid mistakes, what are the mechanisms? So again, I'm calling on you because you come from such different backgrounds. What examples have you seen of approaches to bringing together those two disparate pieces of knowledge? Now, universities are a venue for this, right? Because we've already collected the students together. We've already scheduled the class time. The rooms are there. So it is one venue for doing that kind of teaching. But one of the arguments we've heard out throughout the day is that perhaps the academics that are traditionally doing the teaching are not in the best position to transmit the kinds of knowledge that those students need if their goal is to actually go out and do it. Right? So the question then, how can we best engage the people of commerce in the flow from knowledge creation to knowledge use? How do we get these things together?
There is, I don't know if I'm going to get right on top of that exact issue, but I think one of the things that mediates or prevents that from happening that hasn't been brought up here is that there's a lot of talk about how academia has to be restructured and about the things that it can do, and yet there's not been a recognition that it has to do all these things with considerably less resources than the Canadian institutions had 20 years ago, and nowhere near. I mean, you can't imagine MIT in Canada. There are no resources there. to do that. You know, it is extremely hard. The third year business plan development classes that we teach at the University of Ottawa have 100 students in them, right? How much individual care? And that's one of your four courses, right? So how much individual care can you give to any individual student to develop their business plans when you have 400 of them, right? So, you know, it's important, I think, that there's an appreciation of the structure or the situation in which this all happens. And, you know, there's also, I mean, if business is calling upon academia to reform itself and to get in the game and to train better people, there's got to be more resources there to do that. And, you know, not to take it too far off, but, you know, it seems hard to believe that universities will be able to maintain anywhere near the funding they have now when the healthcare costs continue to increase. And so, you know, that's the context in which this is happening. And so, you know, when we start to put down and say, these are all things that we're going to do, and it gets a bit at Barb's issue of incentives, right? There's also real constraints, major constraints. And until, you know, we have a dialogue and figure out how you change those constraints, I'm not sure how we're going to be able to accomplish more.
Other observations on this topic?
In relation to the question that Rob just posed, I was struck this morning, just an illustration of what he was talking about, how Michael Arbo could talk authoritatively about the tax credit scheme that he initiated in New Brunswick and how it was used and how he was desperately looking for some way to measure its impact and evaluate it. And at the same table, Jean-Marc Sauté, who, as the academic, had examined the patterns and the structures and the various ways in which governments have tried to intervene in that market and to try to draw some generalizations from that. So just an illustration of those two different kinds of knowledge that we saw today. And I still stand before you not knowing how to bring that together in a systematic way.
Yeah. Good example. Any other comments, or would you like to try something else? Okay, well, I'll give you one last one, and then we'll go to that reception, because it sounded like there was lots of wine. Okay, well, let's switch topic a little bit. This morning, we spent much of the morning talking about financing issues, and one of the things that a good number of people appeared to agree on is that the gap in the market is not so much at the institutional level of investment, but those earlier stage of investment that's really not efficient for the larger institutional investors to become involved in. And we heard statements like, what we really need are more business angels, more organized business angels involved in the process. So let's talk a little bit about that. What are some of the mechanisms that might be useful to encourage more angel entrepreneurship, to encourage more organization of angels, and perhaps to involve angels more in the process of educating young entrepreneurs so that they're aware of what, and, you know, the role of angels from the start. Yeah, what the heck? You'd be a good start for that one.
Just to kind of recap, I think, some of the things that maybe we touched on this morning, perhaps we could underline. There's certainly an appetite within my experience in Canada. There are a lot of people who have been successful entrepreneurs who want to give back both to the entrepreneurial community, to the young SMEs, but also to the university community. And one of the things I've discovered in setting up, in helping to set up 12 angel groups in the province of Ontario over the last 2 years, is that I started off from a big city experience. I come from Toronto, so universally I'm hated across Canada. This is good. And so what I learned from a Toronto perspective, because we go right across the province, is that particularly in smaller communities, angel investing is not a philanthropic exercise, but there's a tremendous impetus, desire, I guess is a better word, to kind of give back to the community. And one of the things that I saw is that people would take more of a risk in smaller organizations and in things that, geez, weren't necessarily high tech or med tech or things that would only perhaps get to be a $10-20 million company a year. But they wanted to invest in that in terms of bettering the community. And I remember sitting beside a guy who got really excited in one of these meetings in Thunder Bay, who really got excited about this young woman who had started up two tea shops and wanted to franchise tea shops. I'm looking at this and saying, ah, there's no way. I mean, excuse me. You know, I'm an elitist, and I'm not going to be interested in tea shops. And this guy's really getting excited. And he said, yeah, well, I'm going to invest in you, and I'm also going to mentor you. I'm going to spend some time with you because I've got some ideas. And I said, oh, boy, here we go. So we're having a cup of coffee after the meeting. And it turns out that this guy who I dismissed as a doofus ended up being a guy who built a $100 million business, right, called Robin's Donuts out of Thunder Bay, you know, sold it off. Now, there's an individual who really has subject matter expertise in terms of how to franchise things. And I think I kind of straddle a little bit kind of the business community, a little bit of the academic. I think we can get so precious about what is really important in terms of science, service, technology, or whatever, that we forget too often the real world. And the real world is not composed of of just the rims of this world, right, or the McCains of this world. It is built within the communities, both large and small, and pockets within those communities of people who are really striving and struggling to make a difference. They're not all going to be $100, $200 billion companies, but, boy, they're beginning to make an impact. And in terms of the universities, what I have seen is that there is a tremendous desire by entrepreneurs to kind of come back to the universities. But unless they get, you know, a little letter from or a magazine from University Advancement, they often don't have an opportunity to come back unless they take a course or something. There's no outreach. We're really bad at outreaching other than sending out magazines and phoning up for donations, right, from your alma mater. But one of the things I learned in setting up the alumni-based angel group within the university is I had no trouble bringing back people who had graduated, who were entrepreneurs, who were successful, who were interested not only in investing what the students were coming forward with, investing in what some of the faculty were coming up with, but also the alumni themselves, some of the recent graduates who had started companies. And I really don't think we kind of mobilize that magic that we have in tapping into people's real desire to become re-involved in the university community. And it's just one mechanism, but I'll tell you, the experience that I've had over the last year and a half, I've seen companies being invested in, and not all of them are, you know, but mind you, the first company, you know, and I was thinking $25,000, $50,000 would make a significant difference with one of these companies, with one of these student enterprises. Of course, the first investment was $300,000 in this company, which has since gone on. But what are the mechanisms in terms of getting more of that kind of thing going? We only have one alumni based in all of Canada, right? Angel Group. What is it that we can do within other university communities to begin that? Because you see profs attending that and sitting in these sessions. You see entrepreneurs attending these sessions. And from time to time, you even see some of the administrative folks, like the provost, who sit in and participate in these. If we can find more ways to gather people together in community, I think there's no instant solution, and heaven knows I don't have it. But I am convinced that the more we can bring people together in community, tackling real issues like how do we get these student enterprises funded? How do we mentor these? What are the resources available in the community to begin to connect the dots within the university community and outside? With that sense of community, I think we may begin to understand what some of the answers might be.
Thank you. Very good answer. I think Hamid has a comment in the back.
Rod, I have a question, but I also want to kill a bit of time. Reception is at 5:30. But my question is actually a footnote to what just Dan said. VR is obvious to all of us that we are in the universities struggling to connect in a substantive way with the entrepreneurial community. We have the students, we have the brain powers, we have the professoriate to do the research, but most of our research, most of our efforts are best kept secrets in journals like the one that I publish and the journals that most of us publish. So my question to you, and perhaps to the entire audience, is how do we get Dan Marcils of the world and his network to come to our universities, to our classes, to become part of our training, and on the other side, to have access to the brain power which is there?
You know, there is a real simple answer. Why don't you ask? It ain't that complicated. I mean, you're right. It is the, you know, entrepreneurship is the red light. You know, I'm a product of something that happened above the sheets. Thank you. But we don't ask, right? I'm the world's most unlikely academic. Never wanted to be. Never aspired to be. I kind of fell into it. But I got started because somebody actually asked. And it really, to me, as a serial entrepreneur, as an angel investor, it really also opened up me, personally, in terms of my curiosity, in terms of my learning. I not only teach, I am right now also a student. I'm taking courses. I am 62. I have a T-card from University of Toronto. Right, and I'm a member of the faculty club. Figure that one out. But ask. I mean, we don't outreach enough. We don't kind of say, you're it. Come here. I get a lot of people who sub, and I sub for a lot of people. And I narrow gauge where the contributions can be made. We don't all in this room have all the answers. And by the way, neither do entrepreneurs. In no way, shape, or form. Some of the entrepreneurs, let's face it, got lucky. We're not dealing with the people who got lucky. We're dealing with the people who've done it once or twice or three times before successfully. But integrate them into the community. Don't sit them down in faculty meetings where we're doing baloney research. How thinly can we slice this puppy? Right, to have the chair of whatever say, well, we all know this is a game, and you know, but you got to get into peer review, et cetera, et cetera. Don't do that. That's not where entrepreneurs belong. But, you know, we can all learn from each other. And we don't nearly do enough of that. If you want to break down the silos, break down the silos. Right? It doesn't take money. It doesn't take additional resources. It takes maybe a little bit of brain power, maybe a little bit of organization. But I'm absolutely convinced, I know this firsthand, that there are so many entrepreneurs who would like to come back to the university and don't know how, because they haven't been asked. I know that's not a very elegant answer, but I'm firmly convinced it's part of the right answer.
Any other final observations?
I could just add one more thing. I think competition is could be a rather good facilitator also. The venture cap competition we have back where I come from, we have attached it to academia. And we have, through the competition, established courses for the ones in the competition. And the competition itself is, of course, people apply. The winner gets like $100,000, it should be a little bit more, for the venture. but they get in contact with the investors, and the business angels are connected to it, and the PhDs have special courses for the PhDs in general entrepreneurship that is within academia, and academia itself can adapt those courses the way they want, but it should have a lot of practical side from the industry, of course, in it. But it is there's a lot of possible good cultural building elements within this, between the different sectors again. Well, yep.
Thank you. Any last comments? Alan, did you want to say a few closing remarks? We'll let everyone... Oh, sorry. You're pointing at... Oh, you had a point. Sorry, comment first. No, it's okay.
I appreciate as academics how scary we are. I really don't. I think that many of the people that come are really intimidated about being in an academic environment. And if they've seen, say, an academic PhD seminar, they would be terrified and would never come again. And we really, we do need to ask, but we sometimes are very, we have the cultural sensitivities of nematodes, generally speaking, as academics. And we really do need to understand these guys who are spending their time, their experience. But we are scary. And economists are the scariest of the lot.
I'll do your job.
You have a new role.
So we caught the same plane down this morning at some 6:40 from Toronto, and we were musing in the cab coming in. And I read a stat that was really kind of humbling based on the fact that academics are scary. Anyone can get a PhD if they're so motivated, right, with a baseline IQ of 100. I read that. I didn't make this up. For a CEO of a major corporation, you know what the IQ is? So way above that. Somewhere between 120 and 130. All I'm saying is, we really don't need to be that scary.
Oh,
my school is better than your school.
It addresses a couple of the themes. In one company I have, Research Money, it's a newsletter about R&D, the R&D scene in Canada, and we hold an annual conference. And I wish Tom was here because it was really funny. We talk about issues like this, policy issues that are important for the innovation community. And the early days of our conference, we had... policy people. We used to have an industry panel, a government panel, and a university panel. And in all our evaluations, the government panel was the least interesting, and the university was the next least interesting, and everyone wanted to hear from industry. And I remember one conference we had. Tom Rusowski was there. He was one of the speakers. And we had a discussion like this, and Tom stood up at the end, and he said, this was really good, but we're preaching to the converted. It's all people in the policy community who care about these things, but where are the industry people? And so we changed our strategy because you can't get industry people. They're too busy fighting fires, right? They're getting customers. They were not going to come and spend a day talking about policy issues. So our strategy was we invited them to be speakers. And we got rid of the government panel, and we got rid of the university panel, and we only had keynotes from industry people and panels with industry people, big companies, small companies, venture capitalists, angels, whatever, finance committee. And the evaluations shot through the roof. But the thing that I wanted to tell you in answer to your second to last question was all the industry people, wow, you invited me. I've never been invited to talk to at a policy conference before. And they were thinking about these issues and wrestling with these issues. And they were grateful to come, and they gave their time. And some, we paid their way, but some even didn't let us pay their way. They wanted to be involved with the government people on these problems. So that's one example, just to show you that there's an openness. The one that I want to just throw out to you, actually, there's one other story related to the scary academic. At a research money conference out east, we were in a reception, and I was in a little scrum, and the technology transfer officer of a university was talking to an industry CEO, and we were all sort of part of the conversation. And the university person said to the industry leader, you know, we have a professor who is a real expert in this area, in nutraceuticals. I'd like to get them together with you. And the CEO said, wow, we are the world leader in that area. And he was about to say, we'd love to meet with her. But before he can say that, the face of this gentleman fell, and he was very embarrassed because, A, he didn't know that the company was an expert in that area. And so he started deferring. He said, oh, well, you know. And Robert stopped him and said, no. We're in business. We're in a very narrow area of that. And we talked to universities all over the world, but we didn't know you had people. We'd love to talk with you. And I saw two things there. One, academic arrogance, because the university person thought they were the bee's knees in the area, and a company person could never be an expert. And so he was embarrassed when he found out that the company indeed was an expert. And also ignorance about the way industry works and how open they are to talk with universities, just assuming that, you know, they're the bad commerce people and they don't give a damn about us. In fact, they do. And this CEO was talking to universities in Russia and in China and in India and didn't even know there was someone on his own doorstep. So that's another story. And now the question for you. One area I work in is in the K-12 system, kindergarten to grade 12. That didn't come up today. And part of what I do, sometimes volunteers, sometimes part of my business, is this whole enterprise of trying to get young people interested in science and technology. Don't drop your math in grade 8. Keep it because it could be useful. And I'm very active in that community. And there's a lot of good people and organizations in Canada and around the world working in this area. But I see a blind spot. When they create programs for young people to motivate them, where do they draw the experts? The science and technology experts. 99% from academia. They don't think about going to the private sector where there's really interesting research going on and getting them. We run an engineer in residence program where we get volunteer engineers to go in schools and work for a whole school year with young people from kindergarten all the way to grade 12. 65% of them come from industry. Unfortunately, their bosses say, sure, you can go and volunteer in that school if you make up your time. Mm-hmm. And so corporate Canada, although they talk about a problem hiring good people, and they want more people coming out of our post-secondary institutions with science and technology skills, and they complain about the lack of commerce skills, the people working in the K-12 area, they never talk about commerce literacy, and when they talk about science and technology literacy, they only go to academia. So my question to the group is, what can we do in that K-12 area to help solve in the longer term some of the problems we're facing now in our post-secondary institutions and in our government and our business?
Any responses to that? Perhaps it's a topic for the reception. You can probably. Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Rod. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Actually, this is an underscoring what Jeffrey said, and I'm going to build on that. I really, truly enjoyed the panel discussion, and I'm absolutely convinced that if we had time, each of the panels could have consumed the whole day. So on that basis, that's a presumption from an academic. With that presumption, and I haven't talked this one with my partners, I'm thinking of perhaps editing our proceedings, picking up some of the critical areas that you have discussed, and sending them back to you for your comments. As I said, my thinking is that we really needed much more time. So I think a lot of comments, just because of the shortage of time, was not made. So based on that, if we send, and this is actually a question, if we send the proceedings to you, would you edit them, add to them, add content to that, and send it to us? And secondly, and more importantly, would you release it to us? As the discussion was made today, we need to learn from each other. If we just learn, we have not really provided that service to the rest of the society. If you release your content, we can put it on our website, we can publicize it, we can give it to whoever who wants to publish it. So two-part questions. Should we do this? Second one, would you help us and release your content? Thank you.
Responses? Well, I think you would actually have to have people physically sign off. A show of hands isn't of great. Well, it is for your first question, yes. Yes, show of hands for the first one. Is that would you be willing, if we distribute this back to you, would you be willing to spend a little bit of time with it and give us additional feedback? There you go, Hemi. Perfect. Do you have a few closing remarks that you'd like to make?
My few closing remarks are really just words of thanks. And I just want to underscore Dan's comments about asking, because all the people who were here before you today on the panels, no one turned me down. Every person I asked said yes, and in most cases, enthusiastically yes. And so, Dan, I think that's proof of concept as far as that goes. Let me say some thanks, too. I just want to thank Lina and Francois somewhere. There you are. And Annika. These are our graduate students at Telfer, and they're part of our MSc program in entrepreneurship. Lynn is studying the role of governments around the world in responding to the global financial crisis. Annika is studying the internationalization of services firms, and Francois is examining the performance of immigrant-owned firms in Canada. And these are some of the topics that they're tackling right now. And I know that this has been a learning experience for them, and so I thank you for providing that for them. And I also thank you all for being here, for contributing to the discussion, and making this the day that it was. Thank you. Please have a beer. Come to the reception. Keep talking.